Today is June 12th, 2007. We are at 8th and Center Street, Fernandina Beach, Florida, 32034. The following interview is being conducted as part of the Amelia Island Museum of History's Veterans History Project in partnership with the Library of Congress. We are interviewing Donald Watson Hill, Jr. He was born May 27, 1940, in Decatur, Illinois. My name is Gerhard Tam. I will interview the subject on behalf of the Amelia Island Museum of History. I will also operate the recording equipment, so I will begin the interview. Well, Don, why don't you start off with telling us how a little bit before what you did before you joined the Navy.
Thank you, Gerhard. I was a student and not a very good one. I was not having a great deal of success in school. Sadly, my mother had passed away. Both of my sisters had graduated from college, and there was a financial crisis in my family. And inasmuch as I was not doing well in school, my father drove me down to the Navy recruiting station and slowed down just enough that when I stepped out of the car, I didn't get hurt. He signed the release for me to go in the Navy, not being a high school graduate and under the age of 18. That was in St. Louis. I was 17, as I mentioned. The recruiter asked me if I wanted to go to Great Lakes for boot camp or to San Diego.
What date was that?
That was February 10th, 1958. And it was snowing that day, I'll never forget, and he asked if I wanted Great Lakes or San Diego, and I said, send me to San Diego. And the next thing I know, I was on a DC-3 out of St. Louis and wound up at the Naval Recruit Depot in San Diego. Unbeknownst to me, I mean, I had no idea what I wanted to do in the Navy or had no idea what the Navy was all about, but I was there and ready to go. During the boot camp process, you're tested, as you know, and you go through different processes. And I got fairly good scores, enough to qualify for several good training opportunities. And I had then picked through all these books, different pictures of what trades and what professions are one could go into. And I picked all aviation electronics, aviation ordnance. And I got over sort of one of the near final interviews, and the guy said, you can't go to any of these. You're colorblind. I said, well, no, I'm not colorblind. And he opened up this book that had all kinds of little dots. And then he said, what's that number? I said, there's no number in there. He slammed the book shut, said, you're colorblind. And he said, how about CT? And I said, well, I don't know. Don't know what that is. And he said, it says here communications technician, and it doesn't have any other description, but looks like there's some shore duty involved. And I said, let's do it. So again, at that point, not having the slightest intention of making the Navy a career. Finished up boot camp, and all of a sudden the orders were there to send me to Yeoman A School in Bainbridge, Maryland.
Well, tell us a little bit what your basic training encompassed. What kind of training did you
Well, marching, making sure that you were up and out and clothes were clean. All the cleaning of clothes was strictly a manual thing with a brush and soap on a concrete washboard outside the barracks.
Well, tell us a little bit about it, because that's typically Navy.
Yes.
Yeah. How did this work? I mean, you had your whites and your dungarees? Or?
Yes, whites and dungarees, and your dress blues at that time were on the bottom of your sea bag because you didn't have them out. You got them out for parade near the end of the process. But you literally washed everything and dried everything inside out. Okay.
Every day?
Didn't wash every day. You had a wash period like every other day, if I recall correctly, and you had to find your spot on this concrete slanted wash table with all the guys around you. And then you had to hang your clothes on the clothesline using these clothes stops, little bits of line about yay long. And they had to be knotted perfectly and everything had to be properly hung.
Yay long is about 6 or 8 inches.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right. And then, as part of that process, you got the duty as the clothesline watch for 2 hours. Not every night, but it was a rotating rotary deal, and you're marching up and down, making sure nobody's in there from another competing company stealing your clothes. And, of course, you'd stenciled all your clothes with your service number and your name. And seems to me Reveille was at 0500 and Taps was like 2130 or something, and off you went. But it was a wonderful day when I left there, frankly. It was not a pleasant experience, although it was rewarding in the sense that I learned to keep my mouth shut, keep my ears open, and get on with the process. Don't be argumentative and things like that. So.
Okay, then you went to yeoman school?
Yeoman school in Bainbridge, and I could not figure out why, because there was a yeoman school right there on the facility at San Diego. But it turns out that the Navy was sending all their CT candidates to Bainbridge for no good reason. So, in effect, I got a trip home to St. Louis. And off I went to Yeoman A School in Bainbridge, Maryland. It's way, way out in the country along the Susquehanna River. And the good thing about Yeoman A School at Bainbridge was that it wasn't difficult. The drinking age in Washington, D.C. was 18. And there was a boy in our class, a lad in our class, who always had night school, and he was the only guy with a car. And so down to Washington, D.C., we'd go about two nights a week, you know, like 80 or 90 miles. I can't remember how far it was. I managed to survive Yeoman A School, which was typing, filing, learning the Navy filing system. The base at Bainbridge, Maryland now is long, long closed. I'm certainly certain of that. And then you put down, you know, before you leave school, you fill out your dream sheet, of course. And I think I put down Washington, D.C., maybe California. I can't remember precisely. But the orders came in to a place called Naval Security Group Activity, Futenma, Okinawa. Well, to me, Okinawa was a historical place from World War II. It just didn't resonate. I had no idea, you know, what to make of Okinawa or the thought of going to Okinawa. But the benefit was that another trip home, another 2 week vacation. So I'm beginning to think this Navy deal is pretty darn good. So back to St. Louis for a couple of weeks, and then out to in those days they had what they called receiving stations. It was at Treasure Island, right in the middle of San Francisco Bay, and you would wait there while they sorted out your travel things. It seems to me I was there for like three weeks. And being a potential CT striker, which meant that I was a designated guy, a designated career field, for some reason, that, to those who were there, precluded me from going mess cooking. And one, you know, you could never figure out that why. For some reason, these so-called CTs were treated differently, and I mean that in a positive way. So I worked in an office, filing and typing, and finally the orders came through. I went over to Travis Air Force Base on a bus and got on a DC-6. I'll never forget it. Great Lakes Airlines. And I'm telling you, we stopped at every island between Travis Air Force Base, California, and Kadena Air Base, Okinawa. And that included Hawaii, Wake, Midway, Atsugi in Japan, and then down to Okinawa, which was my first real duty station, arriving there in September of 1958, the Naval Security Group activity in Okinawa. And believe it or not, my first day there, this chief grabbed me. And he said, "Are you Hill?" "Yes, sir, Chief." And he threw Gerhard a white helmet, a white belt, and an old carbine rifle at me. Not the big M1, but the little officer-type carbine. Mm-hmm. Said, "You have the gate guard duty." And he piles me into a Jeep and takes me down and dumps me out in the gate in front of these massive antenna fields, lights, twisted barbed wire fence, no instruction on what to do, just stand there. And it began to rain and rain. And all of a sudden, this Japanese guard sticks his face in my little hut, and I about died. He scared me to death. I didn't expect him to be there. Turned out he was a roving patrol out in the weeds. And he kept saying, "Habu, Habu." I didn't know what a Habu was, and he finally got the word snake out. And during these torrential rains, these snakes come up so they can breathe. Well, I swear to you, this is my first night on Okinawa. I mean, I was scared to death. 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm out there, tears streaming down my face, or maybe my face was wet, I don't know. Probably tears. And the door, the front door of the ops building, maybe 40 yards away, opened, and out came a guy with a cup of coffee and handed it to me. He said, "Hi." I'll never forget this guy. He says, "My name's John Skipper. I'm glad you're here. Good to see you. How about a cup of coffee?" Well, I tell you what, that man became my idol from that day forward. And Gerhard, he was what they call a slick arm first. He had made E6 in less than 4 years. And John Skipper went on to a fabulous career in the Naval Security Group. But for that guy to come out there and do that for me, you know, a punk seaman just arrived on the island, was absolutely the most phenomenal thing that could have ever happened to me, you know, in my Navy career. And it resonates with me even today, these 50 years later.
That's the good Navy.
Yes, exactly, I swear. Sadly, John passed away a few years ago, but as Chief Warrant Officer, W-4. Several weeks later, after working in the personnel office and things like that, I got a note, a call saying, "Get down to ops. You're going to be indoctrinated." My clearance had come in. Oh, boy, this is it. This is what this is all about. So I go down and go through that gate where I had been the gate guard 2 or 3 weeks before and several times subsequent to that. I went in a wonderful E6. Never forget his name either. Casey Wilson handed me this great thick manual that said top secret code word, you know, burn before reading, all over it. And I, for the first time, was indoctrinated into the world of signals intelligence, sensitive compartmental information, comment, call it what you want. I was there, you know. Do you want to do a... my first job, once inside the secure area, believe it or not, was a Chinese Navy call sign analyst. There's nothing sophisticated about this. I would get the collection page prints. I would pull out a 3x5 card file and see if that call sign had ever been heard before. And if it had, I wrote it down that it had. And that was my job. Yeah. And I have thousands of 3x5 cards. And whether or not anybody other than me and that whole processing and reporting division ever looked at those cards, I don't know. But I don't think so, you know. As is the case in, I guess, any part of the military, sometimes the mission changes, the mission moves. And there was word out that a group of sailors, operators mainly, and one chief and one officer were going to go up to an Army Security Agency field station in Japan at a place called Brady Air Base, or Hakata, H-A-K-A-T-A. I also heard that they didn't have an admin-type person going with them. And I went to the chief who was going up there, a chief named Don Detloff, with whom I'd served subsequent to that. I said, Chief, you're going to need a guy up there to keep all you fellows straight administratively. And he went around, said something to somebody, and the next thing I know, 19 of us are leaving, transferring to Hakata in Japan. We flew up to Tachikawa Air Base in Japan, and then we flew down to Itazuki Air Base in Japan, and 19 of us went aboard an Air Force base where there were 800 Air Force guys and there were 600 Army guys and 19 sailors, and we had the best possible deal going. And at that time, moving away from being an intelligence analyst of any kind, and for the remainder of my career, I got into the security administration of Naval Security Group matters. That was my career field from that point forward. A wonderful group of guys doing a wonderful job, and the Army and Air Force guys just loved us being there, and we could do virtually anything we wanted to. It was just a fine, fine tour of duty. Lifelong friends made and generated and kept to this day. The only real excitement during that tour of duty, two things really. A friend of mine and I were in a sailboat in Hakata Bay. An air sea rescue helicopter flew over, swooped down, waved to us, and tipped us over. Dumped us in the bay and then flew away. So we're out there floundering around, trying to figure out what to do. Finally, a rescue boat came out and picked us up. And we're angry. The thing said air sea rescue all the way across. To make a long story short, the pilot called me out of the movie theater that night to apologize to me for doing that, because it made quite a stink.
Yeah.
At Hakata, I made E4. The exciting thing was that our officer in charge, Lieutenant J.G. Jim Gardner, took me to the officers' club to celebrate, and this was a no-no. These Army guys and Air Force guys were just beside themselves to see us in there, but we went in, and it was a horrible, horrible mistake, but it was fun, if you know what I mean. Again, the mission was the Chinese Navy at that particular time. Ahead of time, I got another set of orders. This time, believe it or not, to the 9th Naval District in Chicago. Nobody could figure out why, and it turned out that since I was a kiddie cruiser, having gone in with, you know, before my 18th birthday, I got a set of orders to Chicago, which of course took me home, and not to Great Lakes, but the downtown office, which the office was administering reserves. And I had a chance to go out and visit many of the reserve sites as sort of a mini IG team, checking their records, writing things down for the inspecting officer, and just a great time to see Muskegon, Michigan, and Oshkosh, Wisconsin, places I had never been and wouldn't have gone otherwise. At that point, I got out of the Navy. I stayed out for about 80 days, and I reenlisted. The period of time that I was out of the Navy is not remarkable in any way, other than to say it was clear I needed to go back in the Navy fairly early on. Went off to the Navy receiving station in Washington, D.C., where I was. It was at Bowling Air Force Base at the time, and we waiting for orders. I worked as a typist and did different things, and the next thing I know, I get a set of orders to the Naval Security Group activity at Edsel, Scotland. Brand new base. It's a wonderful opportunity because the base had just opened up within the last 12 months or so. I flew off to London, took the train from London to a place called Bridge of Dunn Station in Scotland, with a nice young guy, Joe Einhat, who's still a friend of mine, lives in Ohio. Got off at this train station wondering where in the world I've never been. It's never been as dark in my life as it was and rainy that day, and showed up at this marvelous base in the middle of the Highlands in Scotland. Some remarkable things happened during that tour of duty, one of which I got married. I was one of those guys that married a Scottish girl. Our anniversary is the 15th of this month, 44 years. Again, long, long, lifelong friends were developed. It was a wonderful, wonderful base that grew from the time I got there, about 40 people, to probably about 600 when I left, and probably had a couple of thousand, all services, when it closed down about 10 years ago.
What was your mission in Scotland?
The mission there was it was the FRD-10 circular disposed antenna array. The mission, of course, was the Soviet Union at that time. My jobs ran from running, wrapping ARF coast, unwrapping ARF coast, to I was the chaplain's yeoman for a while. I was the captain's yeoman for a while. Again, all of this is within the security group umbrella. That was the first time, too. I was an E5 by this time, a second-class petty officer, that I got exposed to the SSO process, the personnel security side of it, where you're the background investigations and being very much intimately involved with that. I was in Scotland for 30 months. My boss at the time was a E6 petty officer named Fred Palakowski, and Fred went off to Washington to the Bureau of Naval Personnel in the Navy Annex. And all of a sudden I got a letter from him one day saying, how would you like to come back to Bupers? Well, this was everybody's dream, to go to Bupers, and by God, if I didn't get a set of orders to go to Bupers in Washington, the Bureau of Naval Personnel, as an E5, to be a detailer. And a detailer is one who assigns people to duty stations. You have X number of billets you need to fill. My job as a detailer was to be responsible for the Naval Security Group linguists. All the so-called I-branchers. Get them into Monterey, get them out of Monterey, for their training, or the Defense Language Institute, and there was one in Washington, Yale University, and then move them around the world. And these are Chinese, Russian, Arabic. It was the start of the Vietnamese language push to get guys into language school. We were always out soliciting people to take what they called the FLAP, the Foreign Language Aptitude Test, and then send them out to language school. The most amazing thing is that very few people flunked out of that school. I was amazed, these kids going in, especially the Chinese and some of the harder, and the Arabic and Farsi and some of those. There were about 900 people that I was responsible for at that time around the world. I also had what they called the O-branchers. These were the communicators, the guys that handled the comment channels, the back channel stuff. I think there were about 1,100 of those. It was a very, very important job for all of us, were second or for E5s or E6s. Later on in the years, all of those guys who filled those positions were E8s or E9s. They took it away from us little guys, you know. I had the good fortune to make first class while I was there. So now, 6 years into my my Navy career, I'm a first-class petty officer at E6. I left there after 2 years and went to a place called the Naval Security Group Activity at Skaggs Island, California. That, too, was a great tour of duty. Skaggs Island is about equal distance between Napa and Sonoma, right on the top of San Pablo Bay. We lived in Napa. Then later on moved on to the base. It was a great, great tour of duty. My commanding officer was Commander Entz, a wonderful guy who later was a rear admiral who officiated at my retirement. One of the interesting things during that process was that it was time for him to get his picture taken for his badge so he could get onto the spaces. And I walk in and said, Captain, would you mind going over to the personnel office to get your picture taken for a badge? Why do I need a badge? Oh, well, Captain, everybody has a badge so you can get into ops. says, I won't need a badge. Well, Captain, everybody has to have a badge. Not me. I'm the commanding officer. And, you know, recognition will be sufficient for me to gain access to every, you know, office on this facility. Aye, aye, sir. And that's the way it was. And that set the tone for his whole thing. He was the commanding officer. Everybody knew it. And he was really top dog. He was a sharp, sharp guy. We were out at Skaggs, I guess, for about 30 months. Remained a first class E6 out there. I got a phone call from a commander named Cahill, who was down at the postgraduate school in Monterey, and he was on his way to London. And he asked me if I wanted to go to London with him. And I said, you bet, Commander, I'd love to go. I'd love to go to London. This would be superb. And what I didn't tell him then, nor have I told him since, was that I already had a commitment that I was going to London. Because I'd just come out of the detailing shop. My buddies were still there. They had a billet. It was a legitimate transfer. So poor Commander Cahill goes back to London to Washington. He's got a list of things. He says, I'd like to have Jones for this job and Smith for that job. And they're saying, no, no, no. He said, I'd like to have Hill for this job. And they said, yes. So to this day, like I say, I didn't tell him that it was a preordained. If I ever get the chance, I will come clean on that. I promise you. So off we go. We fly from San Francisco to New York to London. And I put my family into a one-bedroom bed and breakfast for 30 days while we try to find a place to live. The only thing we could afford was way out of London, called Stanmore in Middlesex, which, interestingly enough, had been headquarters for fighter command during World War II. So I'd get up at 5, I'd walk to the bus stop, I'd take the bus to the Cannons Park tube station on the Bakerloo line, go into Wembley, switch to the Central Line, go into Baker Street Station, and walk 7 blocks to Grosvenor Square, to the Navy headquarters. And, you know, that was a 2.5-hour evolution. And the same thing going home, okay? The problem was that the officers all lived downtown. They walked to work 15 minutes, but we had to keep the office open for all of them to come in and out.
Give me another 5 seconds.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay, we're in London, you know, at the Naval Security Detachment. Again, another wonderful group of guys. An interesting situation there was that the Commander-in-Chief of U.S. Naval Forces Europe, when I first got there, was Admiral John McCain, Senator John McCain's father. And I was on duty the night that he found out that Lieutenant Commander McCain had been taken as a prisoner of war. He had been out to dinner. The Commander-in-Chief Naval Forces Europe lived in that headquarters building. So he was in and out past the duty office, and it was a very trying time for a lot of us. He later left and went to become the Commander-in-Chief Pacific after his son. I had some interesting times there. I made Chief Petty Officer there, which is a very, very important step in a Navy man's career. As you know, the promotion process in the Navy was examination plus a board that had to say, you know, he's the right guy for the right job. Had a very wonderful chief's initiation, which is traditional in the Navy, where you are reduced to the lowest common denominator and you're brought back in your uniform and brought into the chief's to the chief's realm. The next day, I was late to work because we had such a celebration, and I'm wandering down North Audley Street, walk into the building about 9:30, 10 o'clock, and the Marine colonel who was on the staff, Arnie Ziegler, I'll never forget him, was ready. Arnie was only about 5'5", But when he talked, he was about 6'10", and he absolutely chewed me a new one because I was the only guy with the combinations to the safe, and everybody was out of work until I got there. So my chief's career was on tenderhooks right there at the very outset. Great bunch of guys working on the team. Captain Skinner was the oldest captain in the Navy at the time, and just was great to everybody. Commander Cahill was the deputy, the guy who brought me along. But the real standout in that period of my life was a warrant officer named Bernie Farrar, who was my immediate boss. And I had a real bad falling out with a Navy lieutenant commander over there who had for the first time got my dander up in the Navy. And Bernie kept me from ruining my Navy career by grabbing me as I went down the hall trying to catch this lieutenant commander. And to this day, he remains one of the finest Navy guys and friends I could ever have. And he retired as a commander, which is a very honorable career. Then all of a sudden, another set of orders come in, and this one assigned me to NSA in Cheltenham, England. Well, nobody can understand because I'd only been there a year and a half, and it's a three-year tour. So the word went out that I had tried to manipulate this. Well, I didn't know anything about Cheltenham or what was going on down there. But the guy who was the boss of Cheltenham was right across the street, a fellow named Herb Conley, an NSA GS-18. His office was in the embassy. And Captain Skinner went over, and old Herb said, no, we don't even, we don't know Chief Hill. We know who he is, but we need a chief down there. And it turns out to have been the best change of duty that I could have ever had. I went to the General Communications Headquarters in Cheltenham, England, right into the British Signals Intelligence Service. And made, some lifelong friends. My boss was a civilian. The big bosses were civilians. There was a Navy lieutenant commander who was sort of a titular head over us, but he didn't impact us either positively or too negatively at all. And I was fortunate enough to make warrant officer while I was there, but only after being there a year. They had redone my tour. I was supposed to be there for 3 years. Well, old Herb Conley, the GS-18, goes back to NSA, and NSA goes to Bupert saying, let's keep Warrant Officer Hill here, because the Navy had a policy when you got commissioned or became a warrant, you got transferred. Yeah. And Bupert came back through NSA and said no. They went back and said, let's keep Warrant Officer Hill here. NSA and Bupert came back and said no. Went in one more time, and this time it came back and said, please advise Chief Hill that if he wants to be a warrant officer, he'll accept a transfer. If he doesn't, he can remain there as a chief petty officer. So they threw it right back in my lap. And I got transferred to Washington, D.C., the Naval Security Group headquarters at 3801 Nebraska Avenue. And that was in June of 1970. So I'm 12 years into my Navy career at this time. I got assigned to a wonderful job. I was in the security directorate, personnel security, physical security, all the SSO rules and regulations, all the background checks and the adjudications, certification of sensitive compartment and information facilities. It was just a wonderful job. To be part of all of that. At that time, I rewrote and published the Naval Security Group Personnel Security Manual, for which I received the Navy Achievement Medal, which was a very rewarding situation. I also had many, if not all, of the original Pueblo debriefs and threat assessments in a safe next to my desk. And there were some real heroes on the Pueblo. There really were. There was one bad guy who rebuilt a crypto machine for the North Koreans that no doubt went off to the Russians. But the beatings and the trauma that those guys went through was absolutely unbelievable. I have no idea how to compare it to what may be happening today, but back then it was some serious, serious stuff. The problem was that they had clearly too much stuff on board. They had stuff that wasn't applicable to their mission. It was out there as a contingency, just in case. And consequently, the emergency destruction process didn't run as smoothly as it should have. One result of the Pueblo was, or one non-result, I guess, Admiral Zumwalt was the chief of naval operations at the time, and everybody was pointing the finger at everybody else on why this happened. And Zumwalt put out an edict that all Navy flag officers would have the same clearances and access as their four-star boss. Well, everybody thought that was a good idea until it got to the director of NSA, and he says, I'm not giving all this access to every Tom, Dick, and Harry and Supply Corps and engineer officer to... that was a great tour of duty. And fortunately, during that period of time, not only did I make CWO2, but I got deep selected for CWO3. Instead of being in grade for 3 years, I was only in grade 1 year, which accelerated my paycheck and a few other things. It was a very, very positive step. The reasons for which I am hard to explain, other than I got to work on time and I did my job, and I hope I did it honorably. We lived in Laurel, Maryland at the time, owned a home, and I stayed 4 years in that job in Nebraska Avenue, and was enjoying my life in and around the Washington area. And when it was time for me to get transferred, I asked for a transfer to Fort Meade. And by golly, I got it. And it worked out. It worked out quite well. That was in 1974. I went to the Naval Security Group activity at Fort Meade, Maryland, as the enlisted personnel officer and as the assistant special security officer. And I had the good fortune there, marvelous good fortune, to have as my commanding officer at the time Captain Fran McKee, who later became the first female line admiral in the Navy. She put on 2 stars. She was a marvelous, marvelous lady, a marvelous, marvelous commanding officer, a marvelous, marvelous captain. One of the problems was I got along fine with her, and I didn't get along with my XO, which was, that's no fun, because the XO is the guy that has his thumb on you. And it turns out that they didn't get along. And the XO knew that the captain and I got along. Therefore, he was going to be a little bit more astringent on me. Stu Gordon was his name, a wonderful guy, but he and I would just lock heads. And I said to him one time, Commander, if you don't like the way I'm doing my job, you may want to replace me. And he said, I'm thinking about it. And I figured that's the worst thing I'd ever said in my whole life. I apologize. And from that day forward, I would never say that to anybody. If you don't like the way I'm doing my job, they're gonna take you up on it. And again, Captain McKee made admiral. Our duties and responsibilities were to administer to the over 1,000 Navy enlisted people assigned to the National Security Agency, both at Fort Meade and around the world. It was a good job. During this period, I was selected for what they call LDO, the Limited Duty Officer Program. And being a CWO3, even though it had come a couple of years early, kept me from becoming an ensign in the Navy, and I was promoted directly to Lieutenant JG. So I didn't have to wear the ensign's bar or be a second lieutenant or anything, which was a nice thing for them to do. But my tour was up. It was time to transfer. So with a wife, 2 kids, a dog, and 15 pieces of luggage, I went back to my very first duty station, the Naval Security Group activity on Okinawa. So out we go, this time with family, a different location, a different facility completely. Okinawa, of course, during that period, was 1977, was in the throes of being turned back over full-time to the Japanese from the Americans. And during the time that we were there, we switched from driving on the right side of the road to driving on the left side of the road, a transition that was significant in and of itself. Okinawa had grown tremendously since I had been there many years before. As a matter of fact, I went through 71 traffic lights between my house and work, and most of them were red all the time. So it was a good tour of duty. At this time, I was again the administrative officer, the special security officer, dealing with a lot of problems, as a matter of fact, because it was the drug era, and a lot of these kids with the security clearances were getting into the drugs, and we had to debrief a lot of people. We lost a lot of people to the drug world at that time, and that was a shame because so many really good guys got involved with that. The tour in Okinawa was 30 months. When the tour was up, I asked the detailer if possible I could go to Pensacola, where this Navy Cryptologic Training Headquarters is in Pensacola. He said, no, I need you for this important job in Washington. During that period, I was promoted to lieutenant, 03. I went back to Washington, back to the Naval Security Group Headquarters on Nebraska Avenue. Spent a year in officer training, setting up quotas for the Naval Postgraduate School for officers to go into language school for cryptologic training. And I stayed there a year, and I had a job offer to whenever I got out, and I decided to take that job offer, and I retired from the Navy on the last day of April 1980, some 22 years and 2.5 or 3 months after I first enlisted.
Right, okay. Okay, Don, you retired from the Navy now. What did you do now after that?
After I retired, I went to work in Hanover, Maryland, which is right outside of Fort Meade, for a company called Ford Aerospace, on an NSA contract that was dealing with operations and maintenance of the NSA site at Menwith Hill Station in England, otherwise known as Harrogate. I stayed with that program for 2 years. Then I was hired away by Bendix Field Engineering Corporation in Columbia, Maryland, to continue to work on NSA programs, and both of those jobs required that I keep my security clearances. And then in 1984, Bendix won a contract with the Marine Corps to set up some pre-positioned combat equipment and supplies that would be placed on ships and deployed around the world to Guam, Diego Garcia, and into the Mediterranean. And at the time, they didn't have a program manager to deal with that. So I went to the guy who was in charge of that program with Bendix and said, look, I'm a former Navy guy, but my belief is that a manager can manage and a leader can lead. If you need a program manager, I'm your guy, which was sort of out of character for me, believe me. And 2 days later, I was in Albany, Georgia, being introduced to the meanest-looking Marine Corps colonel you've ever seen as the Marine Corps' MPS program manager. We started the program Labor Day weekend 1984 in Wilmington, North Carolina. Later, the program moved to Jacksonville, to Blount Island, right off of Heckscher Drive, and subsequently, my company transferred me down here as the program manager. My wife, I was sick at the Holiday Inn at the airport one day while she was out with the real estate lady, and they somehow wound up on Amelia Island. She called and said, I haven't found the house, but I found the place. And that more or less answers the question of how we arrived in Fernandina Beach. And we first moved in down here in 1987. We moved back to Baltimore for 2 years, 92 to 94. And we moved back in 1994 permanently, and I retired from what had become, Bendix had become Allied Signal and had become Honeywell in 1997.
So you retired in
1997. Right. And become a lifelong resident of Fernandina Beach at this point.
Okay, Don, I thought that this was a great interview. In conclusion of the interview, we'll sign off. I thank you for sharing your recollections with me and to the benefit of the nation. This concludes the interview with Donald Watson Hill, Jr.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.